How do we talk to the people in our life, whether a loved one or a stranger, when we feel like they aren't taking rules around social distancing seriously? We'll get advice from a psychologist. Plus, this spring has been a difficult one for athletes and fans. Everything from Little League to the pros have been suspended to help contain the spread of the coronavirus. And we'll also hear from a sociologist and children's book author about a different kind of book for kids, one that doesn't shy away from complex themes. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, and WNIJ in DeKalb. And our show starts right after the news. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Reginald Hardwick. The coronavirus pandemic has upended the way we're accustomed to interacting with others, from strangers to our closest friends and family. A temporary ban on large gatherings means no sports, book clubs, or birthday parties, and now a trip to the grocery store even requires us to mentally calculate how far we are from other shoppers. Public health officials say all these measures are necessary to keep the virus from spreading. We've also heard the warnings coming from other countries, like Italy, where their healthcare system has been overwhelmed. Even so, not everyone is heeding this advice or those orders. Maybe you have an older parent out of state who insists on their regular shopping trips to a big box store. Or maybe you're a parent and your young adult child isn't following Governor Pritzker's stay-at-home order and is still gathering with a few friends. How do we talk to the people in our life, whether a loved one or a stranger, when we feel like they aren't taking these rules to stay apart seriously? Every Thursday on the 21st, we're tackling a different mental health-related topic, and today I'd like to welcome back Alexandra Solomon. She's a clinical assistant professor of psychology at Northwestern University. She also has her own practice where she helps individuals and couples, and she trains graduate students in family therapy. Alexandra, thank you for joining us on the 21st.
So good to be with you, Reginald.
And just a reminder, we would love for all of you listening to join in the conversation. Maybe you're having difficulty convincing friends and family to practice physical distancing. Call us at 800-222-9455, 800-222-9455, or send us an email or record a voice memo and send it to talk@21stshow.org. Alexandra, I'm sure many of our listeners know someone who maybe isn't taking these stay-at-home directions very seriously. What are you hearing?
Yes, I do think that, you know, we could plot all of us on a spectrum from, you know, life as usual to incredibly hunkered down. And even if, you know, our mother or father is responding responsibly, if they're one degree less serious about it than we are, it can be cause for tremendous anxiety and upset because we, you know, they're even just that little difference can spark a lot of feelings in us.
And what about when someone we know, like a parent, for example, they may be over 60 at more risk of complications for COVID-19, still doing things, you know, maybe that they're not supposed to do, like going to the store when it's crowded or seeing a small group of friends. I think I saw a picture on Twitter about all the folks walking up in the Chicago area together on the path. What do you give that advice to a parent without creating conflict?
Well, exactly. So what I want us to avoid is kind of coming in, you know, already upset and coming in with sweeping statements like you always or you never or you're being so. And I really want people to lead with a lot of curiosity. So I think a lovely opening question to a parent who is behaving in our eyes recklessly would be to say, can you just talk to me a bit about what is so hard for you about this? Like a genuine curiosity of, just help me understand how this has been for you, like what's difficult for you. And that may give us a little bit of insight and then a bit of leverage later on in the conversation. But that whole problem solving, we need to hold off on until we have really just kind of, what a therapist would say, held space for. That we lead with empathy and we hold space for just like, tell me, mom, what's hard for you about this? Like, talk me through what it's been like for you to have your your style cramped, your life shrunk down.
Now, this is March 2020, and we know a lot of people are on social media. And today, even I was looking at an exchange with folks, and there are definitely folks who, cite certain sources of information, may not be legitimate news sources, but they really believe what they're reading, or they've heard, there's more flu deaths than coronavirus, and they may not get their whole minds around the explosion of cases. And maybe they're going to cite those facts. How do you have that talk without, going into a lot of conflict?
Well, I agree. I think that is one of the biggest challenges is when family members are getting their news from different places where there isn't kind of listening to scientists and taking this as seriously. And that is definitely an uphill battle. So I think, again, I worry about families getting into my news versus your news. And I want families to really stay focused on the relationship. And then the next move may be to say, can you help me? Can you help me? I'm incredibly anxious and I'm afraid and I'm worried. And it would be so loving of you to really follow these recommendations to help me out. So that may be a way of just really talking about what my experience is. Sometimes in my field, we talk about an XYZ statement. So when you continue to hang out with your friends during this time of social distancing, I feel scared and angry. So when you do X in situation Y, I feel Z. So when we can frame it like an XYZ statement, and we're really inviting our parent to see how hard this is for me. When you're hanging out with your friends, I feel so scared. I want you around for a very long time. So enlisting our parent to see our struggle, our fear, our worry may help us towards that end goal more effectively than trading news sources back and forth.
And again, our lines are open. Call 800-222-9455. 800-222-9455. We're talking about trying to convince those family members and friends that physical distancing is really for the best for all of us. We were talking about talking to your parent. Let's talk about your adult child who is no longer underage, but has their own mind. But again, you really care for them, and they're not taking social distancing seriously. How would you speak to them?
Yes, I think this is another twist. An equally challenging situation is for a parent to accept the limits of their control, right? So a parent can lead with empathy. They can sort of say, I want you to be responsible. We all have a duty here. And then at that point, at some point, if it really feels like we're spinning our wheels and our adult child isn't listening to us, then it does become a shift into, okay, so then here's where I need to put a boundary, because if you aren't going to take care of yourself and the people around you, I at least need to be protecting myself, right? So there's some effort to connect, some effort to influence, and then at some point it becomes an issue of boundaries. If you aren't going to protect yourself, I at least am going to need to make the choice to protect myself.
And teenagers, I imagine, is another group. I'm sure parents of teenagers might be struggling right now with school out in Illinois at least till April 7th and possibly even longer. Your kids aren't able to see their friends, and how do you keep all these teens from automatically getting together and even younger, but keeping them 6 feet apart if they do get together?
It's so hard. It is so hard. So I mostly just want to validate how incredibly difficult this is and how very real it is for teenagers. We know that for teenagers, developmentally, their peer group matters a lot. They aren't just trying to be a pain in their parents' neck. They just really anchor their developmental, lives and their on their peer group. So I encourage parents to just have a lot of latitude around FaceTime and screen time. And I think that those are the stories I hear. I'm the mother of teenagers, and those are the stories I'm hearing, that there's lots of, FaceTime hangouts. And thank goodness that this generation is so fluid and fluent on their phones, and so they can create opportunities. My daughter and her friend did a little personality quiz together last night and spent some time on the phone together doing that and being a bit creative about, how they could be together while they're apart. But it really is. It's incumbent, painful as it is, to have empathy for our kids. This isn't easy, but then also to have clear expectations and agreements.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with psychology professor at Northwestern University, Alexandra Solomon. She also has a psychotherapy practice. She's giving us some strategies on how to talk to loved ones about taking social distancing rules seriously to stop the spread of coronavirus. You can also join the conversation at 800-222-9455. Again, 800-222-9455. And I think one thing that a lot of people are wondering, you know, you're in this space all together, maybe you're used to your independent lives, and then you do need some space because you're all under the same roof. You know, how do you say, you know what, I do need some time away from family, you know, and I'm not used to this without hurting everyone else's feelings?
Yeah, I mean, the truth of the matter is we are all scared and we are all stressed. And when we are feeling that way, our emotional reserves can get a bit depleted. So we may have a sharper tongue than we usually do. We may feel less patient than we usually do. And so the biggest thing we want to be doing is just damage control. So if I'm feeling like my fuse is short and I may say something to my family members that I'm going to regret later, I'm going to say something like, I love us too much to continue this conversation. I'm going to step away and take a break. And that way I'm taking responsibility for I'm not saying you're making me crazy, you're making me mad, because nobody is making me feel any kind of way. That's just the way I'm feeling. And so I'm going to step away lovingly and calm myself down before I say something that I'm going to regret. That's the biggest thing, is just, that's the tricky thing with anger and irritation, is it feels in the moment like we have to say this thing, we have to get this out, we have to deal with this right now. In fact, we don't. In fact, our most important sort of compass north at this time, our guiding principle here, needs to just be limiting the damage we do, and just remembering that everybody in our house has had their worlds upside down, and that can help us connect back to a sense of compassion and grace, you know, for ourselves and for the people that we are sharing space with.
I think we talked about this a little bit last week. You know, there are mental health services, and maybe they might have to kind of do things differently, maybe over FaceTime. But what should one do if you think you need, you know, some additional help right now, or just reaching out to therapy, you know, and are those services kind of being, you know, booked up really?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, just because we are, you know, stuck in our homes does not mean that we can't be doing therapy. And I'm connected to obviously a large network of therapists, and we all, you know, we've all transitioned to teletherapy. So we're working via Zoom or other, you know, web-based platforms and doing therapy. So the Family Institute where I work, we have offices all over the Chicagoland area. We have sliding scale services where we set fees based on families' income. We also take health insurance and have some out-of-pocket clinicians as well. And so that's, the Family Institute is a great resource, a great place to start in terms of individual, couple, and family therapy, all of which can be done, you know, remotely, screen to screen at this time. And certainly it is a time where having some therapy, some additional support is essential.
Okay, we've talked a little bit about friends and family. What about strangers? So we do still have to go to a grocery store and pick up some things, and there might be times where it's a little more crowded, or maybe someone's walking. You know, you're on a sidewalk and you're a little bit close. How do you gently remind strangers, you know, I'm practicing social distancing without offending them?
I love the way you just said it. It's so gentle. I'm practicing social distancing. It's so much more gentle than you need to step back, or you're too close to me, or step back, or what are you doing, right? So really just locating the comment within ourselves. I'm practicing social distancing. Or stepping ourselves back, you know. I went to the grocery store yesterday, and it was so strange. It's so strange to be frightened of fellow human beings, right? To not want somebody else to be near me. But I needed to go in this particular, you know, freezer cabinet, and I waited for somebody to step away. And so if we walk, I think if we take the responsibility of walking into a space and knowing that we are going to take responsibility for where our bodies are in space, I think that's really helpful. Strange and sad But helpful, and it's what it means right now to be a good citizen, isn't it?
I wonder, you know, we know first responders and doctors kind of prepare for these kind of situations. Do you do that as well in the mental health field?
Yes, I think it's now is a more important time than ever for us as therapists to be having lots of time for peer consultation and to be talking to each other and just having, you know, having our finger on the pulse of what are some of the dynamics that we're seeing and how are you handling this and how am I handling this? And one of the things that we've been talking a lot about is with our ongoing clients, you know, our client maybe came in with a marital issue and now we are having to kind of walk this line of working on the original problem they came into therapy with while also working on whatever this current crisis is kicking up, because that is one thing that is certain is that the crisis right now, having to change our lives as much as we do, it can really wake up some old traumas, some old wounds, whether that be about some financial insecurity that maybe we grew up without very much, with, you know, bare cupboards and some food insecurity, but maybe now we live as an adult with bounty and plenty. But at a time like this, it can sort of awaken those old feelings and those old fears. So we as therapists are talking a lot about how can we have an ear towards our clients' current concerns, but also listening for ways that this current crisis may be stirring up old stuff in them that is sort of surprising and confusing, and helping our clients make sense of that.
Great. Alexandra Solomon, Clinical Assistant Professor of Psychology at Northwestern University, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And a reminder, every Thursday we're talking about mental health issues during this coronavirus crisis right here in the 21st. Coming up after the break, it's been a strange March for sports fans. What to do about all that? I'm Reginald Hardwick. You're listening to the 21st.
The 21st is made possible in part by Busey. Whether you're just starting out or upgrading to your dream home, Busey can guide you every step of the way, because they know there's no place like home. Busey, fulfilling dreams since 1868.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Reginald Hardwick. Usually, the spring months are an extremely busy time for sports at all levels. In past years, near the end of March, fans could turn on their TVs and see the NCAA tournament, NBA and NFL games, the beginning of the baseball season, even the Masters tournament for golf. That's not to mention the tens of millions of children nationwide who play sports at the local level this time of year. This year, the spread of the coronavirus, stay-at-home orders, and social distancing guidelines have changed the course of the season. For many, a spring without sports, professional or otherwise, has left a gaping hole. And as uncertainty around the coronavirus and its implications continue, many are starting to wonder what effect this forced hiatus might have on athletics in the long term. Earlier this morning, WILL managing editor and resident Cubs fan Brian Moline spoke with a few different sports aficionados about what the past few weeks have been like for them. Cheryl Ray Stout covers everything Chicago sports for WBEZ. Will Leach also joined them. He is a national correspondent for MLB.com.
Cheryl, let's start with you. You've been covering sports in Chicago for more than three decades, and I'd imagine it was a pretty surreal feeling for you when you first heard that the NBA season would be suspended, then, you know, the start of the Major League Baseball season delayed. That was supposed to begin today. Can you walk us through some of what was going through your mind earlier this month when all this started happening?
Well, I was at the Blackhawks game, and as we're watching the game, Brandon Saad scores a goal, and then we hear about what was going on with the NBA and that you had a player that tested positive, and it wasn't long after that where they were shutting down the league that night. And then the next day it took the NHL some time to get their situation. They shut down, and it was a slow moving, but it became a tsunami, because I think the NBA set the tone. They knew that they had to do something fast, and they did. And then the NHL, soccer, and of course, baseball. So it was a It was a shock, but at least they did it. They didn't sit and wait any longer than they had to.
Sure. And Will, I'm curious what it felt like for you as things that, you know, that I know that you love, like the NCAA men's basketball tournament, the start of the Major League Baseball season. What was it like for you watching those things fall by the wayside?
Yeah, you know, in many ways, I'd written a piece about this for New York Magazine earlier in the week. I know it seems like they did this early. In many ways, they were probably a little bit late. I think that, there were people at spring training games on the Thursday, the day after Rudy Gobert had tested positive, and after Tom Hanks and Trump's disorienting address, I would say. I think that there were still games that day. There were still people gathering that day. In a lot of ways, I think some people think it even almost went a little bit too slow. A lot of this really does come down to the competitive timelines in these sports. Like, you know, the college basketball, there was no way they were ever going to be able to put that tournament together, considering the uncertainty. But look at something like the NFL. The NFL right now is still acting like everything is normal and everything is fine and they're on their general schedule. Now, while that's been helpful for some of us that work in the world of sports, the Tom Brady to the Buccaneers basically was like a sports talk stimulus package for the for the kind of conversation. But they may be living a little bit of an illusion themselves, because I think the delay that this is going to have, I think, is going to be more expansive than a lot of these sports leagues are necessarily prepared for.
And Will, in a piece you recently wrote for the New York Times, you say, quote, "Sports provides a kind of framework for life, a way of marking time. Every year is a little bit different than the year before, but has essentially the same parameters." Can you talk a little bit more about what you meant there and how you've used sports events as a way to kind of mark time?
Yeah, I kind of joked in the piece that, like, if you say the word 2004, the first thing that comes to my mind is not a presidential election and what happened in my life. It's the Boston Red Sox. You know, if you say 2000, basically it's only 2001 and 2011. That's only because my son was born and the Cardinals won the World Series that year, so it's close. Like, usually when you think of years, a lot of sports fans think mark it by what happened in that sports year. And I think there is a constant consistency to it. I think when you're going to see the kind of disruption that you've seen in the sports year, I kind of made the argument in the piece that, you know, obviously I miss sports and we really miss sports right now. But I think one of the reasons sports was so slow to cancel is not just money. It was the idea that, like, you are losing something if you lose a year from the record books or from the memories. And there's a disconnect, and it almost becomes a, wait, can I, like, the idea that, that there would not be an NCAA tournament would have seemed unbelievable in any other context. And now it's been like a week and a half. We've already kind of gotten used to it. And I wonder what more things we're going to get used to perhaps in the weeks to come.
And people who aren't part of the sports world might not understand how big of an impact it can have on people, you know, emotionally and psychologically, or why it's such a big part of their lives. You know, for me, the NCAA men's basketball tournament and the start of the Major League Baseball season have always been a way to mark spring and something that, you know, you always look forward throughout the winter. Cheryl, I'm wondering if you can kind of talk about what sports have meant to you in your life.
Well, sports is what I did as a kid. I grew up with eight brothers and sisters, and sports was our only way to get out of the house and do something fun. So it was that. But my grandfather lived with us, and he came from Poland, and he used to deliver coal to both Wrigley Field and Old Comiskey Park. And so he, when he retired, he lived with us, and he showed me how much you could love a game. This man didn't speak any English, and he came here, and he learned English by watching TV and by, you know, talking to people. And so that connection, I had that connection as a kid, and it was always part of my life, even though I was denied playing Little League because of Title IX wasn't available and being able to do sports in college because it wasn't available. But I still had that passion for sports. And I understand what, you know, the way the fans are probably feeling right now, because it's a loss. I think people are mourning a little bit about that, although the overall view of what's going on is much more detrimental than our love and the lack of sports. And yesterday I was talking to some Olympic gymnasts and wrestlers who can't go to the Olympics, and you could hear that they understood it, but it's painful for them because they've been working towards the Olympics for 4 years, and one, she's supposed to go into Yale. She's put 2 years off of going to Yale to be able to be in the Olympics. She doesn't know if she's going to be able to do that now. And another is a wrestler who's 33 years old. This was going to be his last Olympics, and he wants to get on with his life post, you know, sports. So it impacts you in so many ways, what's happening right now.
Yeah. And Will, something else you wrote about in that New York Times piece was the potential for the history of sports to be lost. And I'm curious if you can give us an example of what you meant there.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think of baseball as my personal favorite sport, and I'm kind of going through what you're going through, Brian, the idea that, like, I know it's spring, but it doesn't feel like spring because there's no tournament and no baseball. To me, I always go back to 1994. You know, that was the year that the World Series was canceled because of a labor issue. Then it was a horrible thing. And to me, I was in college at the University of Illinois when that happened. And just the idea that there was no World Series felt like there was no Christmas, like there was no Thanksgiving, like something that had just been ripped away. But, you know, in a certain context, you know, if there was a year where we didn't have a Thanksgiving, eventually you would remember the year that there was no Thanksgiving, but it would evolve into all other years because you would have another Thanksgiving, because we don't keep historical records of our Thanksgivings. The idea that every single time from now on, when, you know, baseball is a sport that is obsessed with history, obsessed with consistency and constancy, when you look and realize, oh, 1994, there was just no World Series. And I think a lot of sports leagues are going to be dealing with that. The NCAA tournament's already dealing with that. The idea that you know, I talk about as a Cardinals fan, you know, my grandfather watched Stan Musial and my father watched Bob Gibson and I watched Ozzie Smith and my son watches Paul Goldschmidt, and that kind of connection, that's a huge part of what baseball is the idea that it is always there. Sports are always there and they're always happening. When you cut that connection, I think it's a bigger deal than just, oh, I'm frustrated, I'd like to be watching sports right now. I feel like you're actually potentially fraying one of the things that really does connect fans and the games that they spend basically their entire lives being obsessed with.
And Cheryl, of course, sports are not just something that people play for fun. They're also a big business here in the U.S. And mm-hmm. What kind of economic costs are we talking about here as the NBA, Major League Baseball, other seasons are suspended or maybe even canceled?
Yeah, we're talking about billions of dollars, billions and billions of dollars. A lot of the teams, like that were supposed to be still going on right now in the NBA and the NHL, they are still paying their day workers, so that's going on. And that's what we were listening to Rob Manfred yesterday on ESPN, and he was talking about they're trying to fit in as many games as they can when they can start. They're talking about having maybe 7 innings and doubleheaders, and so because they're trying to get those games in, because they themselves are going to lose billions of dollars. And so everyone, we know the players are trying to figure out their service time and who can be a free agent. But I still think about the person that the vendors, the ticket takers, you know, the gamblers are all going crazy right now too, because they can't make any money. And so it's a tsunami, as I use that term again, of people losing out financially, everybody from the ticket taker to the owners to the players. It's impactful, and you can't make that up. These games, everything's going to be shortened, so there's no way that they could financially make that up unless you become creative. And we're hearing possibly, like, if the NBA can come back, maybe they won't finish the season, but maybe they'll have more teams in the playoffs, and that's one way you can make money. Same thing with the NHL. And baseball is talking about possibly going get as many games in, and they would play the World Series in neutral sites well in to late fall and almost early winter.
Interesting. Cheryl Ray Stout, that is, covers everything Chicago sports for WBEZ. Will Leach is a national correspondent for MLB.com. Both of you, thanks so much for taking the time to speak with us today.
You're welcome, Brian.
Thank you.
And even if we're not able to play an organized sport right now or watch them on TV, that does not mean we can't still stay active during this time of isolation. Getting exercise is an important part of staying mentally and physically healthy. For more on what we should be doing and how much of it we should be doing, I want to welcome Christy Ashwanden. She's the author of Good to Go, What the Athlete and All of Us Can Learn from the Strange Science of Recovery. Christy, welcome to the 21st, and thanks for being with us today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Let's start with this. How can exercise and staying active be good for our mental health and our physical health right now?
Yeah, well, I mean, we're living in this time of great anxiety. And I think one of the things that's really difficult right now is we have so much uncertainty. You know, it's one thing if we sort of know how things are going to play out, but it's like, you know, will there even be a baseball season? We don't know that at this point. And that's really hard to deal with. And so it turns out that exercise is one of the most powerful ways that we have to relieve stress like this. And it's a really healthy way of coping with stress. And getting outside to do some exercise can be really healthy as well. Now, I'm in Colorado. Our governor yesterday just declared a stay-at-home directive, and so we're not allowed to go out and go places. But it was interesting. He was very explicit in saying it is still okay to go outside and, you know, walk your dog, to be outside. The key is staying away from other people, you know, keeping that social distance from people. But I think particularly when we're all cooped up in our houses right now, getting outside, getting some fresh air, getting your heart rate up a little bit, moving your body can be really important both for physical health, but also for psychological health, emotional health. It's just a really good way to relieve stress. But there's also very good evidence now that moderate exercise is very good for your immune system. So it may also be a very important thing right now when we're all trying to stay healthy. It's an important part of that healthy lifestyle.
Sure. And a little bit more on that in our immune systems. Do you have some specific advice for the type and intensity of training we should be doing right now?
Yeah, the very best, you know, if your objective here is to stay healthy, you know, to help keep your body resilient in the face of this pandemic and all of that, then moderate up exercise, you want to probably keep it under 1 hour per day, but something like brisk walking, you know, strength training and things like that are very good. Those are things that you can do inside your house. You don't have to go outside. But anything that's moderate, what you don't want to do is exercise, you know, to your absolute limit right now, because the flip side of this is that very intense exercise can also be sort of an immune suppressant. And this is something like, let's say, running a marathon or, you know, basically going at your close to your maximum for an hour or 90 minutes or more. That's when it really sort of goes from being good for your immune system to being, you know, depressing it for. And this decline in your immune system that happens after that intense exercise is fleeting. It's not something that lasts a long time. But right now we're in this pandemic. We're all trying to stay healthy. So it's probably not a great idea, you know, to start seeing how many hours at once you can run.
Sure. And what tips do you have for exercising safely outside? And what is better about outside than staying in right now?
Well, I think the benefit of being outside is just that fresh air, sunshine, if it happens to be sunny that day when you're going out. But also, like I said, you know, when we're cooped up inside, there's kind of this, you can start to feel a little bit stir crazy. And I think there's just, yeah, there is some scientific evidence that being in the outdoors and around nature can be good for our psychological and physical health. But if you're outside exercising, it's very important that you maintain these social distances. So if you are walking in a park or on a bike path, or even in your neighborhood, and you encounter another person, it's really important that you keep that distance between you. And 6 feet is, you know, the recommended distance. And it can be a little bit difficult because it's not just an arm's length. It's further than that. And I think one thing that's very hard to do is to sort of remember to do this. Particularly, I've had people ask, is it okay to go walking with a friend if we keep 6 feet apart? And the answer, I've run this by experts, their answer is yes, that's okay. But the trick here is that you really do have to maintain that 6 feet. And you know, it's really easy for us to fall back on old habits. You don't want to touch one another. You don't want to pass a water bottle between you. You really need to keep that distance. And that distance is further away than what would normally feel comfortable. And so it's really going to take some vigilance, you know, sort of psychologically to ensure that you're keeping that safe distance.
Sure. Of course, the month of March here in Illinois, and I'm sure where you are in Colorado as well, means some questionable weather. Any tips if we truly cannot get outside?
Yeah, if you can't get outside, you know, do some exercise inside. There are so many online programs now that you can find with exercise programs. There are even ones that you can do that are sort of with a live instructor, and you can do it with other friends if you're feeling really socially isolated and a bit lonely. But even something as simple as doing some push-ups, jogging in place a little bit, dancing, you know, Some friends and I recently had a little remote dance party where we all turned on the same music. We were on a video program. So there are a lot of other ways that you can do this. And I think the trick here is to get creative, but to find something that's enjoyable for you, but some way to get your body moving, because that's really going to be the thing that makes you feel better. Physically, it's helpful, but also I think psychologically, to sort of not be sitting all the time.
That was WILL Managing Editor Brian Moline speaking with Christy Oshwanden. Christy is the author of Good to Go, What the Athlete and All of Us Can Learn from the Strange Science of Recovery. I'm Reginald Hardwick. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Reginald Hardwick. Many of us probably remember a favorite children's book from when we were young. The characters in those stories and maybe some of the lessons we learned in those books still stick with us today. Odds are, though, the book you're thinking of might not have tackled intersectionality. Chelsea Johnson is the author of a children's book that doesn't shy away from complex themes. She's a sociologist and the co-founder of the CLC Collective. That's a partnership of three women of color scholars who publish creative, relatable, and engaging sociology for people of all ages. Chelsea co-authored a children's book with the CLC Collective called Intersection Allies, We Make Room for All. Lee Gaines spoke with her back in January and started by asking Chelsea to define what she meant when she used the word intersectional.
Chelsea, welcome to the 21st.
Thanks for having me.
So, Chelsea, the word intersectional is something we might expect to hear in a college-level course, not something referenced in a lot of kids' books. Can you define for us what you're talking about when you say intersectional?
Yes. So, intersectionality is a feminist concept that really makes clear how institutions and ideologies and really just categories of identity like race, class, gender, ability, citizenship, and culture intersect and give meaning to one another. So basically, what it means is that we're not just our race on Tuesdays, our gender on Wednesdays, our culture on Thursdays, but we're all of those things every day and every single time. And each one of those sort of adds meaning to what it means to be a person in the world.
Mm-hmm. So someone could be both a woman and a person of color, and maybe they're also a member of the LGBTQ community all at once.
Exactly. And that being a woman feels and looks and is different if you're a woman of color or if you're a queer woman. It changes the experience of what womanhood means.
Gotcha. So I'm wondering when you first heard this term.
So I first became introduced to the term and the concept of intersectionality as an undergrad at Spelman College. So for those who don't know, Spelman is a historically Black college for women in the South. And I grew up in Naperville in the suburbs of Chicago as one of the only Black kids in my classroom. And so I intuitively knew that my experiences as a Black kid and a Black woman were different than my classmates. But it wasn't until I got to Spelman where I actually read work by women, by women of color, by people from beyond the United States. And intersectionality was part of that education of really helping me make sense of my experiences in the world as a Black woman in the United States. So that's where I first became introduced to the concept.
So I'm wondering how that concept kind of informed your graduate work, because as I understand it, that's what this book was born out of.
Yeah, so the book was born out of a couple of things that sort of coalesced in a moment of time. I was in grad school at the University of Southern California, writing a dissertation on Black beauty politics. So how what's considered beautiful and what options you have, even in the consumer market, are really a products of our racial dynamics, our history of colonialism, and patriarchy. And I was also writing this dissertation amongst two really good friends who became my co-authors, Carolyn Choi, who was writing a dissertation on educational migration in Asia and how that's experienced differently for women and girls. And LaToya Council was writing a dissertation on middle class division of labor in the household. So intersectionality really helped make sense of all three of our projects, and we were doing that work in academia. But this was also 2016, so the election had just happened. Me Too was at its height, so was Black Lives Matter, and we realized that intersectionality really was a way that to explain a lot of different social dynamics that people were actively talking about at that time. So we started to think about how we could use what we know and our training in the academy and make that really accessible to everyday folks. And this book was part of those two things happening together in our personal and professional lives and also in the world stage.
Yeah, so the book Intersection Allies follows several different characters. Mm-hmm. Can you describe some of them for us?
Yeah, so we have Naya, who's an African-American child, looking at the news and realizing that there are people who look like her facing really difficult situations. And she's learning to grapple with that. We also have Dakota, an Indigenous child. We read this book also when Standing Rock protests were at their height, articulating how profit and power and the environment are all interconnected. We have Gloria, an immigrant child who is street vending with her parents. We also wrote this book at USC in LA, where street vending is criminalized, but that's a way that a lot of, especially immigrant communities, make ends meet. So all of them, their cultural backgrounds, their racial backgrounds, and their place in the world affects really their day-to-day, and we wanted to show that in the first-person perspective through the characters in the book.
And what are some of the big takeaway lessons from the book, or what you're hoping that children and their caregivers, people that are reading with them, take away from it?
Yeah, so we're hoping that children and caregivers really have the language to understand and to reflect on their own racial categories, gender categories, class status, just as a way of understanding themselves. But also a tagline for the book is "We Make Room for All," thinking about how you can use what you have, what privileges or resources you do have, to make room for other people. So all of the characters sort of cascade through the book alongside one another. So while one character might be facing an obstacle on that page, another character is helping them navigate that. Mm-hmm. And so the greater lesson for the book is seeing that, like, nobody is universally disempowered. We all have things we can do to help other people, even though we might be situationally vulnerable. So the book is really hoping to pass along the message that, like, we all have areas where we're empowered, and we should use that in the most beautiful and most communal ways that we can.
Chelsea, I wonder, would you mind reading an excerpt from the book?
Yeah, sure. I'll read an excerpt from two of the characters that I just mentioned, which sort of flow from one to the other.
Excellent.
So, my name is Naya, and with what's on the news, it's easy to be frightened or to sing the blues. For her, for them, for him, and for me, we all deserve to breathe and be free. The color of our skin is no reason to hide. We protest for safety, equality, and pride. Our friends join along in solidarity and love. This is the stuff that allies are made of. Safety also includes our trees and air, the land we've called home, our places of prayer. I am Dakota, and like my ancestors, my tribe and I are water protectors. From profit and power, we stand up to preserve our nations, our cultures, and the respect we deserve. Where there's room for some, we make room for all. Friends can be allies, no matter how small.
That's really beautiful. I love the rhyming. It's just has a really wonderful flow to it. Yeah, I'm curious why you and your co-authors decided to write a children's book versus mm-hmm. something for adults.
Yeah, so really, we think of the book as appropriate for all ages, actually. So intersectionality has become like a word that people use all the time in social media and their everyday conversations, but was really sort of disconnected from the way we were speaking about it in the academy. And we really thought that writing for children was a way of really forcing ourselves to break down really dense language for everyday audiences and even for people for whom English is not their first language. But also, as kids growing up in today's world, children are already developing a critical understanding of how the world operates for people of varying race, class, immigration, and cultural backgrounds. And we wanted to write something that gave kids the words to articulate their stories and craft a vision for a better future, but also do so and alongside caregivers like teachers and parents and grandparents who are grappling with these things at the same time and also need resources.
You know, I'm wondering, since children's books can play such a pivotal role in people's lives, even after they've, you know, grown into adults, are there any books that you were thinking of, any favorites from your own childhood as you started to craft this one with your co-authors?
Yeah, so when I think about children's books that really made an impression on me, two really come to mind. The first is The Giving Tree by Shel Silverstein, which I think is a favorite of many.
Yes.
For me, like, that really helped instill a sense of gratitude. And whenever I read it, I reflected for the first time on my parents. And it seemed that, like, things that I had really came out of the sky. But I hadn't really thought about the impact that all of those beautiful things that my parents gave to me really selflessly required effort and labor and time and investment on their end. And that book really helped me recognize that for the first time. And the second book that comes to mind, or really a series and set of books, are the American Girl series.
Yes, I remember that one very well.
I was such a, I'm a kid of the 90s, so I'm a total American Girl kid. But I loved reading and really being exposed to my history in a first person perspective of a child. And I think my co-authors and I all had like different experiences of American Girl, but that was really like the one set of series that took history and identity and place in the world really seriously in a relatable way. And we thought, like, what if we take that lesson, both of these lessons actually, of gratitude and of empowerment, but an understanding of like that resources are not abundant for everyone all the time, but also reflecting that from the lens of children in a relatable way.
Yeah, it almost sounds like that was sort of a precursor to this conversation that you're starting with your book, Intersection Allies. You know, it strikes me that this book is unique, though, in the sense that it tackles something that people might think of as complex subject material. Do you think that authors are hesitant to have these kinds of conversations in children's literature?
You know, I'm seeing more and more children's books aiming to do just that. That might have been the case maybe 10 years ago, but I think people are recognizing that we live in a really complex world and kids have access to so much more information than maybe we did a generation or two generations ago. So I'm seeing that more and more, and maybe that hesitance is sort of diminishing a bit, which I'm excited about. And I think I would have found really useful myself as a kid.
Yeah, it seems like this book is pushing back against the notion that children aren't ready to have conversations about the world that they live in. I think one of the characters in your book is actually brokering language on behalf of her parents, mm-hmm. who are immigrants. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's our character, Hee-jung. And I should mention that all of the characters are based off of scholarly research, some by people in our network. So Hee-jung's character is based off of Hae-young Kwon's research. He's a sociologist at Indiana University who writes about the experiences of 1.5 generation immigrants, so people who came to this country as children, who often are bilingual. And we don't often think about like the really deep layers of responsibility that kids have when they translate for their parents. They might know more about their family's economic situation. They might be brokering in a medical contacts and know much more about their parents' bodies or their parents' health problems. And we wanted to bring that experience to our readers because it's a really common experience and ever more common.
Yeah. So I'm wondering, have you had the opportunity to read this book, Intersection Allies to Kids?
We have. We have read it in bookstores and elementary school classrooms, in libraries, and it's always a really gratifying experience and always really exciting, I think. Kids have received the book really well, and I think oftentimes are surprised and excited to be able to talk about going back to Honduras and visiting their family, mm-hmm. or protesting with their parents or seeing it on TV. And so we've had like a really positive reception where we're always surprised to hear kids speaking about themselves and feeling really empowered to bring their own experiences into the conversation.
It sounds like they're seeing themselves reflected in this book.
I believe so, and I hope so.
That was Lee Gaines speaking with Chelsea Johnson, a sociologist and co-author of a children's book, Intersection Allies, We Make Room for All. She's also the co-founder of the CLC Collective. That's a partnership of three women of color scholars who publish creative, relatable, and engaging sociology for people of all ages. That's all the time we have today. We are produced by Libby Foster and Anna Casey. Eunice Alpazon is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Reginald Hardwick. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thank you for listening.